Thanks for listening to Here and Now. Help us shape the future of the program and public radio as a whole. NPR wants your feedback and observations to enrich our news coverage and storytelling. At nprlistens.org, you can join the conversation. Voice your opinions. Make an impact. Visit nprlistens.org.
Coming up, Chinese president catches a tiger. We'll explain.
But first, the Obama administration is formally accusing Russia of testing ground-launched cruise missiles, which would violate an arms control agreement that helped end the Cold War. The accusation comes as the U.S. and Europe are also prepared to increase economic sanctions against Russia. Europe already has. Today, Secretary of State John Kerry condemned pro-Russian rebels in Ukraine for not allowing investigators to reach the site of the Malaysia Airlines plane that was shot down almost 2 weeks ago. And he called on Russian President Vladimir Putin to stop shipping arms to the rebels.
President Putin can make a huge difference here if he chooses to. And we and our European partners will take additional measures and impose wider sanctions on key sections of the Russian economy if that is what we must do.
NPR's Corey Flintoff joins us from Moscow with the latest. And first, Corey, to the accusation that Russia has violated that missile treaty, what has been the response from Russia?
Well, I talked to several Russian analysts today, and they had two basic answers. One is that this is being trumped up by the United States as just another excuse to impose heavy sanctions on Russia. And the other is that it's a response to the United States, which has been violating the treaty by using similar missiles to test its missile defense shield.
Well, tell us more about that allegation.
Well, the allegation says basically that Russia tested these ground-based missiles that have an intermediate range that would be from around 300 miles to around 1,300 miles and can carry nuclear warheads. These analysts, the Russian analysts that I talked to, say that very little is known about these missiles in Russia outside of military circles, so it is hard to tell what their capabilities are. But this allegation about the Aegis missile launchers that the U.S. plans to base in Romania is connected with Russia's fears about the U.S. missile defense shield. One analyst I talked to today told me that Russia is concerned that the U.S. is using similar missiles to this to test its missile defense shield and to develop a way to counter anything that might be fired by Russia. So in a way, this is a defensive action by Russia to protect themselves from this missile defense shield, which they really fear.
Either way, a lot of allegations flying back and forth. Does it appear that this treaty could be over, that the U.S. or Russia would pull out of it?
You know, I haven't talked to any non-proliferation people in the United States for a while, so I'm not sure what the U.S. angle on this is. But the Russian angle is that Russia will not pull out of this, and they didn't think the U.S. would pull out either. And that's because this really is one of the core nuclear treaties between the two countries, and it's very important to both of them. Even if they stop negotiating for a while, or even if, you know, they stop talking at all for a while, this treaty would remain in place, and they think it's too important to let go of.
All right, Corey, let's get to the sanctions. Today, the EU adopted new economic sanctions against Russia. What would those do?
The sanctions are reportedly going to be aimed at specific sectors of Russia's economy, such as banking and the military and Russia's oil and gas exports. You know, the sanctions up until now have all been aimed at individuals and institutions. The EU is already sanctioning, I think it's 87 people in 20 organizations, mainly by freezing their assets and banning individuals from traveling. This would be aimed at sectors, and it could be a lot more serious. For instance, if restrictions are imposed on important Russian banks, it would mean that they can't raise foreign investment and foreign capital, and that could affect their domestic industries quite a lot.
But what about the fear from Europe that has kept Europe from putting tougher sanctions in place up until now, that those sanctions are going to hurt Europe's economic relationship with Russia? And Europe is much more reliant on Russia than the United States is, for example, on things like natural gas.
Absolutely. Well, Europe's trade with Russia is something like 10 times greater than U.S. trade with Russia. You know, if Germany, for instance, imposes really restrictive sanctions on Russia, it could lose tens of thousands of jobs. And there's no politician who wants to take responsibility for that. As you said, you know, these countries also rely quite heavily on Russian natural gas for energy, both for consumers and industries. And it wouldn't be easy or cheap to get that energy from somewhere else. You know, and one thing that we sometimes forget about when we talk about the European Union, it's made up of 28 countries that have very different economies.
Right.
You know, some of them are very dependent on trade with Russia, whereas others don't care so much. Some of them, like the Baltic countries, Lithuania and Latvia and Estonia, do have a lot of trade with Russia, but they're so alarmed by Russia's policies that they're prepared to make some pretty substantial sacrifices.
Well, and we've already seen some words of caution coming from the British oil giant BP, which is the biggest foreign investor in the Russian state oil company Rosneft. Clearly, a lot of worry there about what sanctions would mean for BP. Corey, I want to ask you one more thing before we let you go, which is it the conventional wisdom at this point in Russia that it was the Ukrainians who shot down Malaysia Airlines Flight 17?
Absolutely. That's the position that's been promoted on Russian media from the very beginning of this. And every day we see more analysts talking about it, presenting speculation about how and why the Ukrainians might have shot down this plane. Most of them are saying that essentially this was a conspiracy on the part of the Ukrainian government to discredit the separatist rebels in eastern Ukraine and also to discredit Russia.
NPR's Corey Flintoff speaking to us from Moscow. Corey, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And to China now. The country's new president said he would go after tigers, people at the top, in his fight against corruption. And the president's backers say he's now bagged a big one. State media reports that China's former security chief, Zhou Yongkang, is being investigated for a suspected serious disciplinary violation. He used to head China's Ministry of Public Safety and was a member of the country's top decision-making body, the Politburo Standing Committee. He was in charge of the police, the courts, China's spy agency, and he came from the oil industry, so he had a lot of access to money and power and influence. The BBC's Damian Grammaticus joins us from Beijing. And Damian, introduce us further to this man and tell why is he being investigated?
Well, this figure, Zhou Yongkang, as you say, a tiger. He's the biggest tiger ever to be trapped in this way by the Communist Party, ever since the party was founded in 1949. Now, of course, the party runs itself, runs China, so well over a billion people, and polices its own affairs. And never before have we seen in the history of modern China a figure who, like this, has reached the very top. Zhou Yongkang used to sit around the table with the nine men. He was one of the nine men who ran China on the Politburo Standing Committee until the previous leadership, of which he was a member, stepped aside a year or so ago. So extremely powerful figure and a very powerful precedent and message that this is sending.
Well, no, I have to ask you because you really are stressing how big a deal this is, but, you know, bigger than the investigation of the Gang of Four, which included the wife of Mao?
Well, the interesting thing about this is the fact is the way it is being done. What we're seeing here is that there has been, if you like, since then, since those days of Mao and the Gang of Four, a sort of understanding that at the top of the party, they weren't going to be torn apart by internal battles. And the understanding was really that if you reached the very top, the Politburo Standing Committee, you were pretty much untouchable. And this now breaks that sort of unwritten rule, if you like. So what we're seeing is that Zhou Yongkang, who had stepped aside from all his positions, now this announcement, the way things work in China, he's certain really to be punished now and his future, he's finished politically. What's interesting, though, I think, is that we all knew this was coming. This had been rumoured for months since he'd stepped aside. The interesting fact is that it is happening. The current president, Xi Jinping, feels powerful enough to take this final step.
Tell us more about that. What does this say about Xi Jinping, who did take over in 2012 from Hu Jintao as Communist Party leader and China's president? What does it say about him?
I think what it says, I think very clearly, Robin, is that he now feels powerful enough, comfortable enough to assert his power over the Communist Party itself, and it's, remember, it's tens of millions of members strong who run all the sort of official China, the government bodies, the state-owned enterprises, they networks extend all the way through this vast nation. What Xi Jinping, I think, is signalling with this is that he feels absolutely comfortable now in that year or so that's elapsed. He is in control. He is neutralising, really, powerful political rivals or rival networks of power within the party. Corruption is the way he's doing it. Corruption, let's not get too focused on the corruption. This is more about Xi Jinping pulling the levers and saying, I am in charge, and the party, you must listen to me, party members, because I now feel powerful enough to tackle anybody.
Even as at the same time he's exposing, you know, problems in the party.
Well, this is the difficult thing. Absolutely. You put your finger on it, I think. It's very difficult sort of balancing act for Xi Jinping to maintain, because in order to do this, he has to expose some of the party's sort of dirty secrets to the public. What's interesting is that it's quite popular doing this because there is real anger amongst Chinese people at what they see are the excesses and the arrogance of officials who line their own pockets, who they see every day driving around in smart cars, enjoying banquets in smart restaurants, not really delivering services that ordinary people want. So it is quite popular doing this, but it's a very fine line that you have to tread. And I think what we will see is as the details come out in these investigations of the exact levels of corruption, the party and Xi Jinping will try probably to limit those. So we don't know everything that's gone on, but it will sound bad enough, but not too bad to damage the party.
Well, meanwhile, how are those ordinary people, ordinary Chinese, responding to this?
Well, interestingly, we've had already a bit of a sort of eruption of comment on the Chinese internet. Zhou Yongkang's own name has been blocked. You haven't been able to put it in to make comments on Chinese internet sites or search for comments for months, while all the rumours have been that he was detained and under investigation, and this was all being prepared. Now, suddenly, some of that has been relaxed. People are able to make comments, and they are quite supportive. They are praising President Xi for his determination to tackle corruption. Of course, as I said before, this isn't just it's useful publicly to say he's tackling corruption. It's also about the exercise of power in China.
The BBC's Damian Grammaticus in Beijing. Damian, thank you for catching us up.
Pleasure.
Even as the focus of the world has shifted to the crisis in the Middle East, the crisis continues in Iraq. As ISIS advances toward Baghdad, a senior Kurdish official is quoted this week saying Iraq has already broken up into multiple countries. That is especially hard for Roy Scranton to hear. He was a private in the U.S. Army in Baghdad in 2004, and he felt the need to go back to Iraq, so he did earlier this year. His story appears in Rolling Stone, and he's with us now. Roy, welcome to Here and Now.
Hi, Jeremy. Thanks for having me on.
Well, why did you decide to go back to Iraq?
To be honest, I'd been thinking about it for years. Maybe not as soon as right after I got home from there, but Within a couple years, it started to work on me. I started thinking about the missed opportunity of actually talking to Iraqis when I was there, and the sense that I hardly actually knew the country at all, even though I'd spent a year on the ground in Baghdad. And as time went on and the American occupation wore on, that feeling and that desire to go back and both see the places where I'd been before, but also to connect with the people who lived there only grew stronger.
Was that because of guilt?
It wasn't at first because of guilt. It became as when I went back this time in April, I began to feel a sense of guilt as more and more Iraqis talked to me and told me about the destruction and suffering that they'd been living through for the last decade. But when I went, it wasn't so much a sense of guilt as it was of curiosity and a kind of cultural obligation, I guess.
And you went back in April, by the way, which was before the most violent recent round of fighting started in Iraq, and the approach of ISIS coming from the north, especially toward Baghdad. But what was it like in April when you were there, and how was it different from when you were there before?
It was frightening, and it was a difficult time. This was before the most recent surge from ISIS, but it was after ISIS had taken Fallujah and really grown much more active in the north and in Anbar province, and in fact were even in some of the suburbs west of Baghdad. So there was very much this sense that something was happening and that the city was under siege. There were car bombs happening all the time in Baghdad, sometimes as many as several in one week. And it felt very dangerous at first. And all my old military reflexes sort of kicked in, but without the sense of security in having a weapon or having my armor or having 20 other dudes with guns around me. So I felt very exposed. Within a few days that passed and I sort of got used to the low-level tension of being in a city where car bombs go off sometimes, which was like my experience the first time, sort of in 2003 and 2004. When I went the first time, you know, we had all these ideas about what war would be like and what Iraq would be like. And those quickly proved to be sort of inflated and sometimes illusory and sometimes just false. And we got used to doing the work of occupation over the first few months there. And we got used to a sort of low-level tension and a low-level alertness and a low-level hostility that just became the working conditions.
Well, and you write after seeing it just this year that meant having to confront the possibility that we didn't just leave Iraq, we had lost Iraq. Those are your words in the Rolling Stone article.
Yeah. What's happened in Iraq over the last year, you know, has been the disintegration of the state that we left behind and really sort of it shows the evidence of the truth of what we'd actually done, of what we'd built there, which is not a sustainable state, not a real democracy, not a good infrastructure, but, you know, a partitioned, sectarian, corrupt rentier state run by an autocratic leader.
Well, what do you see happening in Iraq's future? Did you speak to anybody there who had any hope for the future in Iraq?
I talked to lots of Iraqis who didn't have much hope at all. I talked to a few who were hopeful for the future, one especially, a young man named Mithaq Walid, who's a student at the Foreign Service Institute, training to be a diplomat. So he was appropriately diplomatic about Iraq's future. He thought it might take 10 or, you know, even 20 years for Iraq to recover from the damage of the American invasion and the occupation and the sectarian civil war. But he did think it would happen. He believed strongly in the power of oil money to provide a basis for rebuilding Iraq's infrastructure. I just got an email from Mithaq the other day, though. He's from a Sunni Shia mixed family. He had to move his family. They lived further north in the country. He had to move them into Baghdad because they're threatened by ISIS now, and he himself had to move.
After your experience there, you've come back and you've written about it, and you're talking to us about it now. What is it that you would like Americans to know about Iraq that perhaps they don't? What message are you trying to get out?
The first is just to think about it at all, which, you know, is not something that it seems like most people are much obliged to do. But when people do think about it, you know, there's a couple important things to keep in mind. One is that this sectarian conflict between Shia and Sunni that's often invoked and often referred to as some sort of ancient quarrel that goes back in thousands of years and can't ever be solved. Well, this was a product of American policy. The germ of the sectarian conflict, the seeds for it, already existed in Iraqi culture before the U.S. invaded. But when we arrived, American policy promoted that conflict and used it. People like Paul Bremer and others used sectarian identity as a way to try to control Iraq and to pit Shia against Sunni. And the other thing is that when we left, we didn't just erase it. When we left Iraq, we remained connected to it through, you know, not just our weapons and the oil and the money and our support for Maliki and all that, but through the impact we made on the culture there and through the impact going there and in being involved in that war had on the thousands of American soldiers and also the impact that war had on us as citizens and on our democracy. You know, things like the torture in Abu Ghraib and the Haditha and the reasoning for the war and the weapons of mass destruction and the whole process of the war. It's not something you can just forget or wash away. It's still living with us.
That's Roy Scranton, an Army veteran of the Iraq War. His story about returning to Baghdad a decade after he fought there is in Rolling Stone. We've got a link to it at hereandnow.org. Roy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Jeremy, for having me on.
Energy use around the globe is expected to go up by more than 50% in the next 25 years. And the couple at the heart of our next story is trying not to contribute to that. They're trying to live completely off the grid in the North Michigan town of Cedar. But as Emily Fox of Here and Now contributor Michigan Radio reports, they're having a harder time than they thought.
Rolf and Mari von Waldhausen used to live a life not that much different from many couples. They worked 40-hour-a-week jobs and lived in an average-sized home. They wanted to reduce their environmental footprint, so one day they did an experiment.
We moved all our belongings into one room in the house and said, let's see how it is to live in a space that's 12 by 16.
Then they tried another experiment.
There was a time that one summer at our house, we actually set up the tent in the yard, and we lived in this tent for 4 months.
Then came the big test. The von Waldhausens sold their house, quit their day jobs, and built a tiny cabin in the woods with no running water or electricity.
We call this our Thoreau's Cabin because this is the place where we get a lot of our inspiration for living the way we do.
The von Waldhausens walk through their heavily wooded property that surrounds their compact home. After they moved here 4 years ago, the von Waldhausens got new part-time jobs, teaching yoga and tuning pianos. They got their water from a stream nearby, gathered wood to heat their wood-burning stove, and used their compostable toilet outside. Rolf says living off the grid is hard work, but he and his wife love it.
This way you get to be out in nature, you know, 365 days a year, and really getting into those natural rhythms that we in modern society have lost.
And they started getting closer to their neighbors. They trade their tools for eggs and syrup. Mari says they began spending more time with people around them.
Most people in most neighborhoods have no idea who even lives next door because you get home after dark and again, you just collapse.
Life was good. Well, that's until the local zoning and health officials found out. Turns out there are two major problems with the von Waldhausen's lifestyle.
A habitable dwelling should have running water to it and should have a means of sanitary disposal of the sewage. That's what our code requires.
That's Clay McNitt with the local health department. The second problem is that their 200-square-foot house is actually too small to be considered livable in their township. Tim Johnson is the chairperson for the Centerville Township Planning Commission. He says the von Waldhausen's house is 4 times smaller than the township minimum.
The ordinance was first written in 1976. It was first enacted primarily, although no one will admit this, but to keep single-wide mobile homes out of the township.
Johnson and the von Waldhausens fought the township board to get rid of the square foot minimum, but the board voted against it. The von Waldhausens are not giving up. Though they can't legally live in their cabin, they can stay in a tent on each of their 3 parcels of land for 2 months at a time. During the colder 6 months of the year, they house sit for friends and neighbors.
It's crazy to try and navigate basically these power struggles in government.
The von Waldhausens say they knew living completely off the grid probably wasn't legal in the first place. And government officials say this wouldn't be as much of a struggle if the couple had talked with the proper local authorities before they started their journey. But despite the bureaucratic and political hurdles, Rolf and Mari are committed to living off their land as much as they can, under the stars and under the law. For Here and Now, I'm Emily Fox in Cedar, Michigan.
Google has started a project to map the human body. The company says it wants to find out what makes us healthy. The new project is called Baseline Study, and it's looking for volunteers willing to donate all their health data. James Temple is a senior editor with our friends at Recode. He covers health and science, and he joins us from KQED in San Francisco. James, welcome.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, let's start with exactly what Google is doing. Tell us what's going on.
Sure. They basically want to gather a lot of data on a lot of healthy people to create a kind of baseline for what healthy looks like. They're going to be analyzing blood work and saliva, doing full genome sequencing, and I guess collecting hundreds of samples in the end, in the hope that it can provide, you know, they'll then run this through their software algorithms and computer networks and try to find out some insights into how to keep people in the healthy state. There, you know, some headlines have said that, you know, Google is trying to create the perfectly healthy human, but that's way down the line. I mean, I think what they're trying here is to figure out what healthy looks like. They're looking for biomarkers associated with wellness or risk factors for what could signal later onsets of certain diseases. The idea is that you might be able to spot divergences from the norm earlier in the process and adjust for them either by changing lifestyle or taking medicine in an earlier state in the hope that you can avoid disease or address it before some of the worst symptoms come to pass.
And is there much difference between what Google is doing here and what has already been done in looking at all kinds of health data and genetic code and trying to find out everything that doctors can, for example, about the human body?
Sure. I mean, it depends on who you're talking about. I mean, most biotech companies, I think it's safe to say, start with specific diseases and work backwards to try to develop treatments after the fact. But we certainly have seen a lot of academic researchers start to look at broad big data studies, specifically looking at the human genome. To try to figure out, to kind of match up what's happening in the human genome versus what's happening in the human body and sort of draw links between the two. So it's, you know, Google is by no means the first to look at things in this particular way. I think one might argue that what could be different here is they're saying that their ambitions are bigger, that they want to collect more data than has been collected before. And the second part would be that Google is really good at the big data side of things. They're very good at creating smart software algorithms that can pull information out of a lot of data. And so I think that's maybe what sets this particular study apart.
And they're very good at advertising to us, which brings us to the question, why does Google want to do this? Why do they want to map the human body?
Sure. I mean, it certainly does not fit into their core business focus of serving up results to your search queries online and matching up ads to those. So why they're doing this depends a little bit on how skeptical you are about Google. There are certainly plenty of people who assume that, you know, they're going to use this as one more piece of data to help match up your search, this data plus your search history in the hopes of creating ever more complete picture of you so that they can get better at selling you shoes online or something like that. But I actually think that's a little bit of a cynical view. Google has said here explicitly that this effort is purely for science, that it's not going to make its way into a commercial project. And you know, I've covered Google for a long time, and they've certainly made their fair share of privacy mistakes, and I've been critical of them for those at the time, but they also have, you know, demonstrated, I think, many times in the past that they are very interested in peer research at certain points, and they've hired a lot of people, particularly in their Google X research division, who are leading experts in their field that are doing, you know, science for science's sake. Some might think I'm naive for this, but I put this particular study into that bucket.
Well, what are the criteria for the volunteers who might want to? And maybe there's somebody listening right now who's saying, well, who do I have to call to get my health data turned over for this project? But what are the criteria for the volunteers who want to give up that data so that Google can map the human body?
Sure. You know, after I wrote the story about this over the weekend, I got a few inquiries of those sort myself, including some of my family members. I checked with Google. They said they're not really actively seeking. They're not providing a route for people to contact them about this at this point, and they haven't given a lot of clues as to the specific parameters for what they're going to be looking for. We know that they're starting with a small scale pilot of about 175 people, and that eventually they plan to ramp up and work with Stanford and others to work on a fuller study. But for now, all we really know is what they're looking for are healthy people, because that's the baseline that they're trying to create.
And you have said that you would volunteer to be a part of this study, although Dan Monroe, a contributor to Forbes magazine, responded to you saying, mm-hmm. here's why I'm not volunteering to be a guinea pig for Google's medical study. And one of the things he says is there's a legal risk for the volunteers and that no one can honestly promise you anonymity or confidentiality.
That's right. And that's 100% correct. And what I've said is that in my story, that there is a risk. Anytime you're dealing with a full genomic sequence, it is the thing that makes you you. And so it is inherently identifiable. If there's another public database out there where that information lives, it can be matched up. But what I've said is that I'd be perfectly comfortable participating in the study if they'd have me, because I did a little reporting over the weekend, talked to Google a few times, and got a sense of the specific set of privacy protections that they're putting into place for this. They've basically said, this data is not going to be posted on a public website somewhere. They will be using it internally specifically for their medical researchers to look at this information for the purpose of this their own research, and that down the road, if they find some informative details in here, they may share that information with outside researchers, but only those already working under on studies that have been, past the rigor of institutional review boards. So I was clear in the story that I wrote that it's not about zero risk, but I think the risks are fairly small, in particular compared to what can be gained from studies like this. I think that there's a lot of potential in big data studies to find some novel insights into medicine and health.
James Temple, senior editor at Recode, covers health and science there. James, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
It's competitive eating season. People scarfing down pancakes, hot dogs, oysters at country fairs. It's gluttonous. It's a little nauseating, or a look at it may be unpalatable for some. And it can be dangerous. A man died in South Dakota earlier this summer. So why is it so popular? Well, Jason Crazy Legs Conti is the subject of a documentary called Crazy Legs Conti, Zen and the Art of Competitive Eating. Here he's being introduced at an event at the Tribeca Film Festival promoting the film.
The David Blaine of the bowel, the Evel Knievel of the alimentary canal,
the Steve Austin of starch, the Houdini of cuisine himself, ladies and gentlemen, Crazy Legs.
Crazy Legs, that's his real name now, and he joins us from the Argo Studios in New York. And you say this isn't for everyone, but start with that terrible death in Custer, a man choking on a Frankfurter. Didn't that put a chill on your profession?
Well, it's undoubtedly a tragedy and something I think that could easily be avoided. In the past, whether there's been radio contests with water or county fair contests with marshmallows or hot dogs, there's a safety factor that has to be taken into consideration. I eat with Major League Eating. That is the governing body of all stomach-centric sports. And at every event, there's an EMT present. If I was going to do a one-minute exhibition in a studio, there'd be an EMT standing next to me. And we only allow men and women over 18 to eat. So safety is paramount to the league.
Well, and you mentioned something that just went by, stomach-centric sports. I'm sure there are listeners saying, oh, come on. But there is a professional organization. There's rankings.
Absolutely. The league has been in existence for about 20 years, founded and run by Rich and George Shea. They're the ones you see on ESPN. Rich is usually doing commentary, and George is on the stage, on the riser, encouraging the Franksters to dance and doing a lot of pageantry, which is what our sport is in part about.
Once in every 10 generations, a hero rises to lead a broken nation to victory, and so he has. The hamburger-eating champion of the world, the hot dog-eating champion.
How did you get into this? I understand it started with oysters.
Yeah, I am from Boston originally, and I was in New Orleans when the Patriots were in the Super Bowl in 2002. I was at an oyster place, and I was looking down the counter, and there was a guy who looked like King Neptune, and he was sort of spearing the oysters as fast as they shucked them. So I turned to my shucker, and I said, "How many has anybody eaten at once?" And my shucker, Kenny, said, "Across the street at Acme, the record's 33 dozen. If you eat 34 dozen, they're free."
Wait, that's 34 times 12.
Yes.
That's a lot.
That's a lot of mollusk. And it took me most of the Super Bowl to consume all of those, but I did.
408. Mm-hmm. You ate 408. And then I understand you ate 459 oysters on the David Letterman show?
I did. I was going for the restaurant record. My personal best is 32 dozen in 8 minutes. It depends on the year. This year, they were very large and creamy, so my numbers fell. But the world record is held.
There's some people that can't eat one oyster.
That is too bad. They really need to work on that. But the world record's held by a 100-pound woman named Sonia the Black Oda Thomas, who has eaten 48 dozen in 8 minutes and is pretty unstoppable.
Is this even physically possible? By the way, you also hold world titles in string beans, pancakes, bacon, beef biscuit, and Twinkies. There were researchers in gastrointestinal imaging who investigated ways to assess the stomachs of world-class speed-eating champions. This was out of the University of Pennsylvania. They published their results in the Gastrointestinal Imaging magazine, and they concluded that successful speed eaters expand the stomach to form an enormous flaccid sac capable of accommodating huge amounts of food. We speculate that professional speed eaters eventually may develop morbid obesity, profound gastroparesis, intractable nausea and vomiting, even the need for a gastrectomy.
That's why I canceled my subscription to that gastronomical weekly. I sort of disagreed. It's not taking into account that what we do is a competition. If I was at a barbecue and someone said, "Here's a platter of 25 hot dogs and buns. Just take all afternoon and eat them," I don't think I'd want to, nor maybe would I be capable of it. But when you tell me it's a 10-minute contest and I have to beat the eater to my left and right, something else takes over. I think in sports, you push beyond. In our sport, granted, we're eating competitively in exhibitions, contests, and media appearances maybe 40 times a year. So that's 40 large meals. You know, in the NBA, they play 82 games a year. So what you do the rest of the time factors into your abilities to eat at the table. And now you have to be in traditional athletic shape. So I've run the New York Marathon. I've run the Boston Marathon. I jog. Everyone has a way to correct the overconsumption by eating healthfully outside of competitive eating.
Well, that's long term. What about in the moment? Where do you put 25 hot dogs in your stomach? Where do you put over 400 oysters? You've got to be stretching something.
It's really mind over stomach matter. The stomach has an expansion limit, but the mind does not. So if you can somehow enter a zone, a zen-like feeling where, you know, the food is moving almost in a robotic fashion. At the Rouse's Crawfish Eating Championship, I think about eating crawfish like flipping cards. It's got to be quicker and quicker, as if I'm a Vegas blackjack dealer. But very rarely do I actually taste the spice from the boil. It's a lot about texture. It's a lot about technique.
That seems such a shame. You eat 30 Maine lobsters in 12 minutes, but you don't taste the lobster.
Well, that was actually one of the four contests in my 13 years that I actually asked for more food after the eating competition.
Oh my God.
So I usually eat one of the food substance after the contest just to get a taste and a feel and celebrate the food. But technique-wise, I'm the four-time corn on the cob eating champion. This year I did 43 ears of corn in 12 minutes. What goes into that is thinking about the most efficient way to eat each corn and to try to stay ahead of people doing either the toilet paper roll or the rake or the Florida stripper. I do the manual typewriter, which is left to right, three times, swallowing.
Yeah, we do that in our family too, but we never thought of it as a competitive sports move. Why do you do it? I mean, we should note you also climbed out on a window ledge naked, washed the window, and ate a dozen donuts in under 3 minutes. Why anybody even asked you to do that, I don't know, but why do you do
that?
That
was combining my occupations with my passion. At the time, I was a New York City window cleaner and a nude model at FIT, and that was to promote the documentary. But I had a few food stuntman-like scenarios where I ate my way out of an 8-foot box of popcorn, a popcorn sarcophagus, and that earned me the moniker the Houdini of Cuisini. But I've found different reasons that I've been a major league eater. in the trophy era, when there was no prize money, it was largely for the travel, the free food, perhaps the groupies. But now I have maybe loftier reasons. In 2009, Major League Eating partnered with Navy Entertainment, and we've sent over 15 eaters on tours of duty to entertain sailor soldiers and all the divisions of the armed forces in bases all over the world. So I like to be an ambassador to my sport. I love the travel and talking to people. There's TV shows, and I've appeared on The Sopranos or Emerald. There's video games, Major League Eating the Game. So I can see somebody playing as my avatar, eating corn on the cob in their commute to work on their phone. All those things are pretty amazing. But whenever you can combine it with something like entertaining the armed forces, it means so much more, and it's certainly much more important.
That's Jason Crazy Legs Conti, competitive eater. Jason, thanks so much.
Absolutely. Thank you, and eat all you can.
Well, to see the Florida Stripper and other corn eating techniques, we have a video posted at herenow.org. And please send all emails about the waste of food to Mr. Crazy Legs.
You can also send all emails about the donut thing.
naked donut eating. The window washer. Yeah. That explains it.
We don't have a picture of that at our website, herenow.org.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.